Lucille Clifton once wrote, "The patience of the universe is not without an end." Welcome to episode 30 of Our Hen House, a place to find our way to change the world for animals. In today's episode, we come to you from the city by the bay, San Francisco. We'll start by telling you about our vegan adventures and maybe some misadventures, including a tale of delicious, cruelty-free Japanese food and a rather disturbing stuffed animal story. We will be joined today by Zoe Weil from the Institute for Humane Education. Zoe, who was just inducted into the Animal Rights Hall of Fame, will talk about humane education, as well as what it really means to do the most good and least harm. In our news section, we will tell you about a group of cattlemen who are having some issues with a recent audit of their spending. We'll also discuss why conflicted meat eaters deny that animals have the capacity to suffer, and we'll discuss the vegan fare at Chelsea Clinton's wedding. In our review section, we will give you our impression of the new film, Chow Down, which follows three people with severe heart disease who have decided to make some serious and necessary lifestyle changes. And trust me, you will be batting for them. My name is Jasmine Singer, and I'll be your co-host today in Our Hen House, along with the icing on my vegan carrot cake, Marianne Sullivan. We're glad that you've decided to join us today in Our Hen House, where here in San Francisco, we found our heart, and it was in a big bowl of Maggie Mudd's vegan ice cream. Now please, pull up some hay. Let's get squawking. I'd like to welcome my co-host, Marianne Sullivan.
Hello, my little vegan ice cream sundae, which is just what we had.
We did. We had vegan ice cream sundaes here in
San Francisco,
which is where we are this week.
Yay.
Been looking forward to this trip for like 3 years.
Not only do I totally love San Francisco, and it's such a great town, and we have such happy memories of it too, which makes it a special place, but also, it's cold here. I love it.
It's like in the 50s. It's in the 50s. It's like if there's a God, she loves us.
New York's been very, very hot for the past month.
And something interesting happened the day we arrived in San Francisco.
It was so nice to arrive on that particular day. It was the day that the Federal District Court here in San Francisco vacated Proposition 8 and found it unconstitutional.
Unconstitutional, that's right. Take that. And a friend of mine who I was talking to here in San Francisco lives in the Castro, which is, of course, the very, very gay area of San Francisco, as opposed to the very gay area of San Francisco, which is the rest of San Francisco. And she said that she couldn't even get into her apartment because there were so many parades going on and people were playing and singing We Are Family.
Yeah, that kind of gives me chills. It's so sweet. I mean, just think that people are all excited because the government is recognizing that they're allowed to be families.
Yeah, it is. It was nice to arrive that day today, definitely.
San Francisco is very gay.
It's so gay. The San Francisco Chronicle had, the day after the decision, this on the front cover, this huge rainbow flag billowing, and in big block letters, it said, unconstitutional, or something like that. I think it was a little better than that, but it was pretty groovy. And yeah, I mean, it's definitely, especially in the Mission, it's so lesbian-y there. And in the Castro, is just so gay. All of the above gay. So I like it. I kind of want to move here, but not enough to, because I love New York so much. But I kind of want to, but not enough to. But I kind of want to, but not enough to.
Okay, well, when you come to a conclusion on that, let me know.
Okay.
There is the earthquakes.
Yeah, but you know,
Yeah, I guess there's always something.
There's always something. And we have been to Chaya, which is a vegan Japanese restaurant, which I think is so awesome because there's kind of not
anything like that in New York. I mean, you could get vegan sushi, but this is a vegan Japanese restaurant.
Yeah, it's really superb food, too.
And afterwards, we headed over to Herbivore for some ice cream, and that's where we had Maggie Mud's ice cream. I haven't been to Maggie Mud's yet, which is a vegan ice cream place, but Herbivore does sell Maggie Mud's ice cream.
Not quite like getting at the actual authentic place itself. I know you're a little disappointed you haven't gotten there yet.
I'm going to get there. And you know what else was cool? At one point, for some reason, you were in the mall at the food court, and there's a Loving Hut vegan cuisine huge in the middle of the food court in this mall in the middle of the Tenderloin.
I know. That was so cool. Supreme master people.
Well, maybe they like Bette Midler and they're the divine supreme master.
Yeah,
I agree. They know where it's at. And actually, this one kind of icky thing happened. We were in the Mission, and do you remember this, honey? We were walking past like a children's toy store, which of course meant we had to go in because it was a children's toy store, and it was called.
We don't like children. We like toys.
What was it called? Paxton Gate. Yeah, Paxton Gate's Curiosities for Kids. And so we go in, and it was absolutely shocking.
Yeah, they had these little plaques on the wall, and on each plaque was mounted the head of a stuffed toy animal, like the head of a teddy bear, mounted on a plaque on the wall. Oh, my God.
Like, I mean, we just couldn't believe it, as if to just put in these little kids' heads that it's okay to have, like, trophy animals. And so,
you know, it gave me the absolute willies. I just thought of my little teddy bear, like, up on the wall.
Don't say that. It, like, breaks my heart and makes me miss the teddy bear we left in New York City. There, I said it. I admitted it. I have a problem. I have a teddy bear problem. So what? But do you remember I actually annoyed you when we left?
Well, yeah. I mean, which time?
Very funny. When we left the place with the dead the dead stuffed animals who weren't really dead, but still on the wall, I just started to make a really loud big scene saying how disgusting that was and how I'm never shopping there again and getting all huffy and puffy.
Remember? And yeah, of course I remember.
I felt like passive aggressiveness was called for, but you brought up the fact that maybe I could have actually communicated my point with them. Very good point indeed, honey. And then anyway, so we left.
So I must admit that my feeling on that was based on the idea that maybe these were people that could be talked to, and maybe it was just some kind of horrible misjudgment, but we were soon proved, or I was soon proved wrong.
Disgusting. So we're walking down the same street, Valencia Street, and we stop because we see a horse's head in the window of this store, and we were standing there trying to figure out if it was a real horse, and we decided it was a real horse, and we noticed that it's the same store, Paxton Gate, but it's not the kid version.
Yeah, and we also noticed that not only do they have a horse's head, which had been cleverly modified to make it a unicorn by sticking some
stick thing
in its head.
Yeah.
But then we look at the wall and it's covered in trophies.
Trophies, like actual animal heads. When you're a kid, it's a stuffed animal head, but these were actual, like there was a bull and there were deer and there was all these other animals. It's just like a couple dozen of them. It was unbelievable. So disgusting and horrid, and Jesus Christ, I hate humans sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, the whole thing was really deeply disturbing.
Yeah, it really was. But
so now we only are not disturbed. We got to disturb everybody who's listening to this podcast. Yeah. That was nice of us.
Yeah, sorry about that. It's true. But we have had some wonderful times, too. I went to visit our friends over at Veg News, which was amazing. I just love them so much that I just want to, like, cuddle with them. Is that inappropriate?
Well, yeah, highly. And unfortunately, I didn't get to go because I had to do ABA stuff.
No, you did. But I had a really, really awesome time, and they made lunch for me, and we missed you. And we're going to have dinner with them next week, so you'll get to see them then. But we're here because of the ABA, because this weekend you are going to become the chair of the Animal Law Committee for the American Bar Association. So we're here for the ABA annual conference. So how's it going? Any, are you saving animals, making people go vegan, things like that?
Well, that's kind of, you're setting kind of a high standard. I wouldn't say that I've actually pulled that off yet.
Has anyone had any tofu?
No, that would be too horrifying to imagine. It's a pretty conservative group, but I think that, you know, we do have an opportunity to make some headway, and we have a lot of exciting events coming up. I think I've talked about them before on the podcast, but we, in particular, we have coming up our vaccination clinic in Oakland, where the lawyers from the ABA will be helping out getting pit bulls, mostly pit bulls, vaccinated and fitted for new collars. And so that'll be fun.
If pit bulls are involved, that will be fun. I've noticed a lot of pit bulls around town. We saw one at this thrift store we were at today. Of course, we were already thrifting. We went to called Community Thrift, and there was just the most beautiful white pit bull, and his human got him a frisbee there, which was so cute and sweet. And Community Thrift, score!
Yeah, we got some good stuff at Community Thrift. Yep. And here we are staying at the Hotel California.
Are we going to be able
to? It's a lovely place.
Are we going to be able to check out?
We can check out, but we can never leave.
So it's in the same building as the Millennium Restaurant where we're going to be eating this weekend.
Yay!
Yeah, it's pretty exciting indeed. And back at home, guess what happened? You know how our launch is coming up on October 1st, right?
Yeah, because you never shut up about it.
It's on October 1st, and it's a chocolate and wine party, and Jane Velez Mitchell will be our special guest there, and Victoria Moran is speaking, and Joshua Ketcher is speaking. Anyway, and Rescue Chocolates is donating the chocolate. Guess what we got? We got a wine donation from Frey Wines.
Frey Wines, they're just the best.
They're 100% vegan, organic, and they're just absolutely amazing, and they're now one of the sponsors of the launch party. Thank you, Frey Wines. So exciting. Just so completely exciting. But before the launch, we still have our this year trip in San Francisco, and we're actually going on a 3-day vacation. Not work-related, nothing. We're going to Big Sur.
Yes, I can't wait.
Can we call it Big Madam? Get it? Sir and Madam.
Yeah, it's funny, Annie.
I'm so excited. Oh, I forgot to tell you, Elizabeth from Veg News told me that the drive there on the one is the prettiest drive she's ever been on in her life.
Yeah, I actually did that drive many years ago, and it is, it's beyond pretty. It's spectacularly beautiful. It's a little scary.
Ooh, I'm excited, and I'm intrigued, and I'm going to turn my goddamn computer off and my phone off for 3 whole days. Nothing.
You crazy kid.
I know. I know. It's truly crazy. It's insane. But we have a great show today, our San Francisco show. We're speaking with Zoe Weil, who has such a great name. I just want to keep saying it. Zoe Weil.
Yeah, she doesn't pronounce the E. I kind of like that.
I do, too. I think that Zoe Caldwell does the same thing. I wonder if they got it from each other. Maybe not. People are like, who's Zoe Caldwell? She was in Masterclass. Sorry. Okay. But I digress. We're not talking to Zoe Caldwell today. We're talking to Zoe Weil, who is from the Institute for Humane Education. And I'm so excited to hear everything she has to say.
Yeah, me too.
So let's get right into that interview now, shall we? Zoe Weil is co-founder and president of the Institute for Humane Education, which is dedicated to helping create a humane, peaceful, and sustainable world by educating people to teach about the interconnected issues of animal protection, human rights, and environmental preservation, and by advancing humane education worldwide. Zoe created the first Master of Education program in humane education in the U.S., as well as a humane education certificate program. She travels throughout the U.S. and Canada, leading workshops and speaking in communities and at schools, conferences, and colleges. She is the author of several books, including Nautilus Award Silver Medal winner Most Good, Least Harm, A Simple Principle for a Better World and Meaningful Life, The Power and Promise of Humane Education, Above All, Be Kind, Raising a Humane Child in Challenging Times, So You Love Animals, an action-packed, fun-filled book to help kids help animals, and the Moonbeam Gold Medal winner in juvenile fiction, Claude and Medea, about seventh graders who become clandestine activists in New York City, rescuing dogs from an evil vivisector. She blogs at www.zoeweil.com, and that's ZOEWEIL.com. Welcome to our hen house, Zoe.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here. We're big fans of you and of everything that you're doing with humane education. And we heard that you were recently inducted into the Animal Rights Hall of Fame. Congratulations.
Thank you.
How did that feel?
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, initially I was stunned. I felt like I was entering this illustrious group of people who are my heroes. And you know, I at first didn't feel worthy of it, but then I saw it really as a validation of humane education, and that felt awesome.
Yes, that is a very good way of looking at it, and it's absolutely true. What an honor. That's so cool. Now, what do you see, speaking of humane education, what do you see as the core values of humane education?
Well, the way we define humane education at the Institute for Humane Education is very broadly. We see it as a comprehensive field that interconnects human rights, animal rights, and environmental protection so that we can educate a generation that has the knowledge, the tools, and the motivation to make choices in their lives and to become change makers for a better world for everybody.
Well, that's certainly hard to argue with, though I guess you do end up arguing with some people. I'm curious to know how the certificate program works. How do people, do they come to you? You mentioned distance learning. Do they take the course from afar? How would people go about getting this certificate?
Great question. People can do this program from anywhere in the world, and we have had students from all over the world in it, and they come to us for 1 week, and the rest of the time they're doing the program from home, and we have an online forum, and all of the teaching takes place through conversations with their fellow students and their faculty through the internet and, or the phone, but they're doing the work at home. But then we also have month-long courses, and people can do those from anywhere in the world as well. And they have daily exercises where they have to do some work, and then they have an online commons where they can talk to the other students in the program and their facilitator of the program and really create an incredible community. I mean, people are describing these courses as life-changing and completely transformative. Right now, we're just ending a month-long course for teachers to learn how to incorporate humane education into their classrooms. It's called Teaching for a Positive Future. And we have teachers from all over the place who are creating activities, creating curriculum, figuring out how they're going to incorporate humane education directly into their classrooms. And same with activists who want to become teachers, and they are learning the same sorts of things as well. Can I tell you about some of our upcoming ones?
Yes, please do.
So we have in the month of September, we have one of these month-long courses. It's called A Better World, A Meaningful Life. And this one is for anybody who really wants to examine their values, examine their life, examine their talents, examine their passions, and put it all together to make a difference in the world. So anybody who is ready to step back, pause, look at their life and look at what they're doing and figure out how they can do more and better of what they really want to make this world a better place, this is the course for them. And then in October, we're going to have a month-long course called Raising a Humane Child, and that's for parents who want to learn how to incorporate humane education ideas into their parenting so that they raise children who are compassionate and courageous and honest and respectful and responsible.
Well, that's great.
A great idea. I didn't realize that you went so far beyond just teaching teachers.
Well, yes, we do. We teach individuals who really want to, you know, the way we think of it as this, is that we are trying to train people to be humane educators promote humane education and also offer humane education. So we occasionally go into schools and do programs for students directly. Most of what we're doing is training humane educators because we want to reach more people. And the more teachers you train, the more people you're going to reach. But then we also do workshops all over the country in Canada that we call MOGO workshops, MOGO being short for most good, which is short for how to do the most good and the least harm in all of our choices to animals, to other people, and to the environment. And those workshops are for anybody, teens to elderly people who really want to examine their life. And people love this workshop, but the reason why we have the distance learning course is because not everybody can get themselves to a workshop, but anybody who has a computer can take our course and then have a whole community of people from around the world who they can talk to online.
And is that the Sowing Seeds workshops?
The Sowing Seeds workshop, thank you for mentioning that, is another workshop that we offer, and that one is for activists and educators who want to teach about animal and environmental and sustainability and human rights issues. And so those workshops are teacher training or educator humane education training workshops. Whereas the MOGO workshops, which we call A Better World, A Meaningful Life in the online course, those workshops are for individuals who really want to examine their life and make whatever choices they're going to make a better world. So some of those people may become humane educators, but, you know, some could decide that they want to work on legislative issues. Some could decide that they want to be innovators and inventors of different kinds of things that are going to make a better world. I mean, people can go in so many different directions. It's the opportunity to really assess, what are my skills, what are my passions, and put them together to make a difference.
Well, for me, I actually took a Sowing Seeds workshop before I started working at Farm Sanctuary, like, I guess, 3.5 years ago now, and it was a really awesome experience. I wasn't sure what to expect because I wasn't a teacher, and there were teachers in the room, but there were certainly non-teachers in the room, and as you said, just activists who wanted to hone their skills and learn communication techniques for reaching out and have humane education, sort of some humane education experience in their back pocket. This is especially useful for people who lead workshops that I feel the Sowing Seeds are. Like, I went around to different colleges and led workshops on veganism and activism, and having Sowing Seeds was really helpful to pull those skills out when I needed them.
So that's so great to hear.
Yeah, it definitely was a really awesome experience. And I remember during the Sowing Seeds workshop that I took, there were different activities that we would do. I'm sure you would be able to talk about them better than I. But some of them, which I've actually seen you do, Zoe, when I've seen you speak at TAFA, I think the year I was speaking there in like 2008, there's one activity you do where you ask people to stand on like a crate.
Milk crates, yep.
Can you explain that activity
sure.
a little bit?
Sure. In fact, I was just at the AR conference in TAFA, and I used the milk crates there as well. So I have two volunteers come up from the audience and take off their shoes and socks and stand on upside-down milk crates. And the idea is to experience kinesthetically in their bodies what it must feel like to be a battery hen, a caged hen in a battery cage. And so I have them stand up there for a while I go about my program, and then I check in with them and ask, how do they feel? How long would they like to stay? I let them know that, you know, if we can provide them with food and water, and if they have to go to the bathroom, they can just go because it'll fall through the slats, and ask them how long they'd like to stay under those circumstances. And, of course, nobody ever wants to stay more than a few more minutes because mm-hmm. their feet really hurt standing on the upside-down crates. And so it's a visceral experience of what it must be like to be a caged animal. And I do it with students in classrooms, too, and they always love to get up and feel what that must be like. Now, obviously, it's going to be different for chickens than it is for humans, but it's an opportunity to really understand what must it be like to be a hen crammed into a cage with 9 other hens, so tightly that you can't, they can't even stretch a wing, standing on wire mesh that for the duration of their lives, which is uncomfortable and painful, and sometimes their nails actually grow around the cage and back into their feet. And so it's an experience to help us understand what others might feel, whether they're our species or not, and to experience some compassion for others. So there are all different ways to educate, and we educate and we learn both visually and auditorily, but also kinesthetically and also by doing. And so as a humane educator, we like to make sure that we're training people to teach in ways that reach all learners and all their different styles of learning. And by the way, at our website, which is humaneeducation.org, we have over 75 free downloadable activities. So anybody can go there. You know, if you can't get to a workshop and you can't take an online course and you don't have the opportunity to do our certificate program, that doesn't mean we can't help you if you're interested. You can still go to our website. You can download our resources and use them.
That's so great that you have that available. It's really available to everyone, it sounds like. Another exercise that I remember the presenter doing was going through his day as consciously as possible and asking the people in the audience who were, we were sort of acting like we were the kids, to help figure out how can we most consciously live our day? How can we most consciously, you know, to take a shower? Is it to turn off the hot water when we're like, turn off the water when we're soaping ourselves up? And how can we most consciously eat? And it was just, I love that. I love bringing that, the idea of bringing that to students and young people and old people too. Why not? Yeah. I mean, that's just really fantastic. So do you know how we can measure the effectiveness of humane education? Do you have any experience in that with being around humane education for so long and being so heavily involved in it?
Well, there are some groups that have done assessment studies and have evaluated the effectiveness of specific programs with pretests and post-tests and things like that. And they have all shown that humane education has a positive effect on people's behavior in terms of they're making different choices. I have not conducted those sorts of things from my own programs, although we have assessed what the people who have been trained by us are doing, and they're doing lots and lots of humane education all over the world. But I will say that I could probably spend the entire time on this podcast giving you stories and examples and quotes from students who have changed because of humane education. I mean, I just had the experience last September of doing a talk with Jane Goodall at a Roots and Shoots event, which was really quite an honor to meet and speak with Jane Goodall. And I had invited a young man, he's not a young man, he's 35, a 35-year-old man to come. He had been a young man. He had been a kid in my very first humane education
That's
course
ridiculous.
That I taught.
You're like 35 yourself. I don't understand.
No,
that at all.
I'm 49. But anyway,
he was fantastic. He was really young.
Thank you. He was in this course that I taught in 1987. And he was 12 or 13 at the time. And I had invited him. He's still an activist to this day. After the course, he went on to found a student group in the Philadelphia area. He won awards. He did incredible activism. Amazing, amazing young man. And he is now working in New York City. So I had invited him to come hear this talk, and I hadn't seen him in about 16 years. And so he came, and afterwards I was introducing him to some of my friends, and I said, "This is David. He was in the very first course that I ever taught in humane education." And before I could even get the sentence out, he had jumped in and said, "That course changed my life."
Wow.
Now, I hear those stories all the time. You know, recently I saw another student who I had taught in a summer course, a week-long summer course, and then stayed in touch with for a short period of time when he was 13. He'd become vegan in that course. And he came to a talk I gave in New York. He's now a corporate lawyer, 30 years old, living in New York City. And I was introducing him to my mom, actually, because she came to the same MOGO workshop in New York City. And he said to my mom, you know, your daughter's the reason I became vegan. And then he told me that he was about to get married in June, and he invited me to his wedding, and this big Philadelphia wedding was going to be completely vegan. And that's because he took that course all those years ago.
Wow, that you must get so much positive feedback.
I do.
In what
it's
you do.
Amazing.
That's really great.
It is. But, you know, even you just now saying, I went to a Sowing Seeds workshop and then it really helped me and I was doing programs in colleges. I mean, that's the first time I've heard that from you. Well, so when I do hear these things, I think, okay, for everybody who tells me something like this, there must be 50 people who I haven't stayed in touch with who are doing those things. So that's my evidence that this is working.
So tell us about your book, which is also, I believe, called Most Good, Least Harm.
Right.
A Simple Principle for a Better World and Meaningful Life.
Right. Well, it's I've written a number of books. I've written a couple humane education books for kids, one called So You Love Animals. My favorite book, which is called Claude and Medea, which is the Moonbeam Gold Medal award-winning book in juvenile fiction, and it's about these kids, these 12-year-olds who become clandestine activists in New York City. And in the first book, I hope it's going to be a series, in the first book, they end up rescuing dogs from an evil vivisector. Anyway, it was really fun to write. But I've also written books for adults. I wrote one for educators called The Power and Promise of Humane Education, one for parents called Above All, Be Kind, Raising a Humane Child in Challenging Times, and the one you just mentioned, Most Good, Least Harm, I wrote for the general public. And it's basically a book that is designed to give anybody, any mainstream person, the tools to begin thinking about their choices and living their values more deeply and making their life an expression of those values so that that will actually benefit them and it will benefit the world.
Wow, that sounds great. I kind of want to get that for everyone this Christmas.
Oh, awesome. We'll give you a deal on that.
Oh, excellent. Very cool. You know, speaking of most good and least harm, it can be very overwhelming trying to live an ethical life, not being vegan, which I find pretty easy, but and a lot of people don't find that easy, but issues like palm oil and sweatshops and organic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What is one to do when one isn't sure of the most ethical path?
That is such a good question, and this is exactly what my book, Most Good, Least Harm, addresses. I try to write a book that introduces everybody to the breadth of issues out there and then ask them to do what they can and to live to the greatest degree possible with what I call the three I's of inquiry, introspection, and integrity. Inquiry, meaning that we ask questions. We ask questions all the time. That does mean that we're going to find out some information that is disturbing and that may call into question our choices. And then we introspect about that. We say, ask ourselves, okay, what can I change? What can't I change? And then finally, to the greatest degree possible, we live with integrity. That just means we walk our talk. That just means we put our values into practice. And I'll give you an example of a way in which there is no way that I can live with integrity because there are no systems in place for it. And that is that I wrote my book on a computer. And I use my computer every day. I couldn't really do my work without a computer. And as many people know, computers have lots of toxins in them. There are ores mined in unsustainable ways. They are often put together in sweatshops when they are disassembled after their short lives. There are children who are being exposed to many of those toxins. Sometimes they're incinerated and those toxins go up into the atmosphere. I mean, there are many, many problems inherent in computers. And yet, those of us who rely on them don't really have a choice. There's no computer we can buy that is an ethical computer at this point. Some companies do a better job than others in terms of recycling and things like that, but there is no ethical computer. So what are we to do? Well, one of the things I focus on in Most Good, Least Harm is how can we change systems? There are systems in place that are always going to interfere with our ability to live really peacefully and humanely. So to the degree possible, we can make personal choices that reflect our values. But that's only one side of the equation. The other side is that we work for change. And we can work for change in so many different ways. We can work for change in our professions. We can work for change as citizens. organizations and through our democracy, and we can work for change as activists. And they're all really important. And so the book helps people to think about how they can harness what their best skills are toward that end, even when there are systems in place that currently don't allow them to fully live their values.
Interesting. I like that, though. I mean, it is hard to grasp all of this, you know. I mean, what's the real answer? Where do we draw the line? So I like that way of looking at it. You know, I have a brand new niece. She's about 6 weeks old at this point. And she's just beautiful and adorable. But it's hard for me, to be completely honest, to look at her and not feel, you know, worry and sadness for her generation. I mean, I'm not even 31, and I feel like, okay, when I'm done, I am done, because this is a very sad world, and, you know, it's not, my feeling is, you know, maybe it won't be around that much longer. Do you have hope that, I think you're a mother, do you have hope that the upcoming generation will live better than the current one? I mean, is there any hope out there, Zoe?
Well, hope is an interesting thing. Sometimes I have lots of hope, sometimes I have very little hope, but this is how I've come to think about it. It doesn't matter whether I'm feeling hope in a particular moment or not. I still have to live with myself, and I still have to do my best. And when I die, I want to know that I'm dying without regrets, that I did what I could. So even on those days, those dark days when I'm not feeling hopeful, it doesn't change what I do, because I still have to live with myself, and I still have to do my best, and I still have to make a difference. But I'm going to talk about optimism rather than hope for a second, because I read recently that optimism is a political act, that it's so easy to be pessimistic and cynical, but it's an act of will to remain optimistic and say, yes, we have the capacity to change things. And we certainly do. I have no doubt that we have that capacity. My optimism or my hope comes into play around whether or not we will harness it and we will do it. But we certainly can do it. And I am going to act and work with full optimism for a better world, and that is a political statement.
I like that too, and I do also have to maintain a certain degree of optimism, or else I don't know how we would be able to keep going.
Yeah, I find that really useful, the idea of considering optimism to be an act of will. I don't know whether I can pull it off, but I'm
yeah. And even if you can't pull it off, you probably are going to still keep doing the good work, because what else is there to do?
Right, exactly.
And what else can you do?
Exactly. Yep. And on that note, thank you so much for joining us in our hen house. It really has been very enlightening, and we are very grateful for your sharing your wisdom with us, and certainly for doing everything that you've been doing for so long for the better good and a better world. So thank you so much, Zoe.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on the show. And I just hope people will go to our website, humaneeducation.org, and they can friend request me on Facebook and follow the Institute for Humane Education on Facebook and get involved with what we're doing.
Very cool. Thanks. That was Zoe Weil on our Hen House. Always a pleasure to talk with someone about humane education, something we're very passionate about, as I hope is reflected in our class act section of our Hen House. And with that, let's get into some news now, shall we? Turns out denial is not just a river in Egypt.
Ha ha ha, good one.
I think that you were referring to this interesting article out of the University of Kent in England, where they did a study, which proves something that we all know, but it was kind of entertainingly put, that people who wish to escape the meat paradox, that is, they actually like animals and don't like to hurt them, but they want to eat meat anyway, do so by entering into denial, and specifically they deny to themselves that the animal they ate had the capacity to suffer. So they can remain compassionate to animals that they don't eat, and of course they somehow convince themselves that the animals they do eat
aren't sentient.
The article talk about any potential ways to penetrate that convenient rationale.
That wasn't really the purpose, I think. But I think just having this information, it's certainly something we all know, but having it scientifically studied is really very useful, because you can actually trot these kind of studies out and talk to people, use them to talk to people about their behavior. And I thought one of the more interesting quotes is that the study showed that when there is a conflict between their preferred way of thinking and their preferred way of acting, it is their thoughts and moral standards that people abandon first, rather than changing their behavior. Certainly, this, as I keep saying, this just carries out what we already know to be the case, but it really is depressing.
Yeah, it really is depressing.
But not altogether surprising.
Also in the news this week, and I guess most people considered this pretty good news, was Chelsea's vegan wedding. Though the veganism didn't get quite the same play in the press.
Well, it wasn't a totally vegan wedding, though, was it?
No, we like to call it a vegan wedding, but yeah, what is the deal with serving grass-fed meat at a vegan wedding?
Right, and it's grass-fed beef, in addition to being bullshit, literally, is also really worse on our planet. Not that anyone should be eating any kind of meat, but, you know, people seem to ignore that fact.
I just thought this was not from an interesting source. It's some blog called The Stir. I think it's a foodie blog, but I just thought it was such an interesting quote. She says, as a carnivore who is vegan curious, and, you know, I think that's pretty cool that she's vegan curious, but moving on. As a carnivore who is vegan curious, I also appreciate the fact that Clinton did serve burgers at the wedding, grass-fed, of course, which shows she has a conscience, but also is interested in taking care of the preferences of her guests, who apparently don't have consciences, just like this writer.
Oh,
what the hell?
I can't believe that.
I know.
Seriously, it's sort of like, remember, there used to be on West Broadway a shoe store that sold Natalie Portman's shoes, and it had this huge billboard up, and it said, Natalie Portman, walk with a conscience, or walk without one.
Yeah, and get any of the other 25 brands that they sell.
Yeah, wow, that's crazy. But I agree, I wish that more attention was put on the veganacity of Miss Clinton, and also I wish that she just made it a goddamn vegan wedding. Chelsea, come on.
I know. Because it just kind of destroys the whole message.
Yeah.
It just makes it like a health decision, sort of, if you think it's okay for other people to eat meat. But on the other hand, you know, it was pretty cool that she exists and that she's vegan and that she had this huge multi-million-dollar wedding and that it was almost all vegan.
Yeah.
There's another piece of news I noticed in the Times, which I found quite entertaining. And you just got to take your pleasure where you can in this business. And there was an audit, apparently, of the spending of the beef checkoff program. This is these government-sponsored programs where they collect money from meat producers, and then they use it to advertise the product. And it's kind of a combination of government and private spending, and the beef checkoff is known for the advertising program Beef It's What's for Dinner. Anyway, this audit found all sorts of financial improprieties, particularly in the financial records of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. Well, isn't it fun to see those guys screwing up? Apparently, they spent this money on lobbying, which they're absolutely, totally, and positively not allowed to do, and on some junkets for the head guy's wife going along on trips. And I particularly love the quote, as explaining why that was, they had no idea that was a problem. We always felt it was important for them to bring their wives along. It's always good to have your wife along to help you get centered. That's not anything different than what's been going on for a long, long time.
Oh my God.
Yeah, what century are these people living in? Well, I guess it's the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
So disgusting. Boy, Carol Adams would have a field day with that one.
Yeah, actually, she would have a field day with several of our mentions today, because I think she'd be very interested in that denial issue, too.
Right.
So that's the news.
And that was her news.
So recently on our podcast, we discussed a new film, Chow Down, and we actually were able to get a copy of Chow Down, and we're excited to give you our review of it. Chow Down is a film that was brought to you by director and producer Julia Greyer and director and producer and DP Gage Johnston. And it really is a film about heart disease and how people in our country who are afflicted with heart disease, which is most people, really have a lot more control than doctors are letting on about how they can reverse their heart disease for good by switching to a vegan diet, though they don't say vegan in the film. They say plant-based.
Yeah, it's not just a vegan diet, of course. It's a very healthy vegan diet and really eating optimally. And it really makes a huge impact about how important this kind of diet can be and how most of the treatments that allopathic medicine is offering for these people, the surgery, the stents, the things we've all heard about, the drugs, they mentioned Lipitor is the most prescribed drug in the United States. All of them are just Band-Aids, and the only real way to address this disease is diet, and none of other than the heroic doctors in this movie, three of my greatest heroes in the world, T. Colin Campbell, Caldwell Esselstyn, and Joel Fuhrman, other than them, pretty much nobody's telling people that they have this option of actually curing themselves.
Right, and in addition to having really educational and useful information out there, and of course incredibly harrowing, the film was very special in that it had the best animation I think I've seen in a documentary. It was just really clever and cool and very professional. And it, of course, I love cartoons, so maybe that has something to do with it, but it did make it very, very watchable, and the music as well. I was really impressed with the quality of the film as a whole, but of course, that's not what you come away with. What you come away with is what you were talking about, that really there's so much more than meets the eye, and allopathic medicine can really just lead us astray sometimes, and it's really up to us to take the power into our own hands of changing our life for the better.
Yeah, and there were not unfortunate parts of the movie, unfortunate parts of the story, in that it was clear that people, the three people who they followed to change their diet in this very, very dramatic way, did find it very difficult. One of them went on quite a bit about how the food didn't taste good, and nobody really defended the food as tasting good. And one of the people did not succeed, and we won't tell you which one. But it was clear, the message of the movie was so clear that you need enormous amounts of support. And if you're not getting support from your friends and family in doing this, it's going to be very difficult.
I found it kind of unbelievable when a lot of the characters were talking about their experiences with their doctors. I mean, these are people that were on the road to dying very young. And a lot of them were talking about the information they were getting from their doctors prior to beginning this experiment. One of them said that his doctor told him to go on a Mediterranean diet. Another person in the film, Charlie, his doctor just asked him about salt. He never once asked him about diet. Not once. This was somebody who had like a 100% blockage in his heart valve.
I think one thing that this movie inspired me to think about was, and I'm always trying to inspire myself on how to eat healthier. And one of the reasons that it's hard is that it's hard. I mean, there's all the cooking involved, and it is difficult to cook vegetables. I mean, it's time consuming. It's not actually difficult, but in the modern lives that most of us live, that we're very busy, we're used to not being required to spend a lot of time to feed ourselves, it can get very time consuming to cook well.
And another thing that was mentioned was the expense of the diet. And there was actually a whole section about how it's much more expensive. And Dr. Esselstyn's wife, Anne, was talking about how it doesn't need to be as expensive. You could just get, you know, some whole grains and some frozen vegetables and beans, and you have yourself a nice, easily prepared, not expensive meal. But of course, part of the reason that it is more expensive is because of food policy. The vast majority of subsidies go to meat and dairy. In fact, we learned in the film the amount of federal subsidies for fruit and vegetables is 0.37%. That's a third of 1%.
Yeah, it's
It's really, truly a disgrace. Our food policy is a disgrace. Our government seems to be in cahoots with the meat industry to kill our population off. It's just so pathetic. It makes me, the movie made me really, really angry.
Yeah, understandably. They also said that the U.S. ranks 42nd in life expectancy, and that's down from 11th 20 years ago.
Yeah, we're a pathetic country. We really are. It was helpful to see that Dr. Esselstein, who at first was very, very disdained for his work with diet, he'd been a cancer surgeon, so it really was a new field for him. And at first he was just really scoffed at. And now he's really been given a lot of power to promote his diet.
Yeah, and he's definitely made a name for himself recently. And that's great to see. And another thing that I think is really terrific about this movie, Chow Down, is its mainstream appeal. I think this movie has the potential of getting a huge grassroots movement behind it. I could see it showing at my grandmother's community center. I could see it showing at conferences. I could see it showing at like health conferences. I mean, it is an animal rights film in the sense that it is advocating for a plant-based diet, but it doesn't mention the ethics of eating animals, and that's not what we were expecting coming in to watching the film. It's part of the reason I think it has such a mainstream appeal is that these professionals, these movers and shakers in medicine are recommending a plant-based diet if you want to, you know, stay alive. And, you know, it's just amazing what people will do to their thought process to allow themselves to believe that the poison that they're eating is okay. They think it's okay for the planet. It's okay for the animals. And they don't really care if it's okay for their health because they want to be happy. And of course, you can be very happy living on a healthy diet as opposed to a disgusting diet full of carcasses and pus. One of the characters, Charlie, mentioned that his mother had severe cardiovascular disease, but she refused to do this diet with her son, even though her son was doing it. And they had the built-in moral support. She wouldn't do it. It's really just kind of unbelievable. And it's also unbelievable that Dr. Esselstein said in the film that heart procedures that are done, like bypass surgeries and things like that, the statistics show that having that does not prolong your life.
Yeah, the treatment for heart disease in this country is apparently nonsense, and I guess that's why it remains the number one killer. I would love to see this movie and this kind of thinking about diet get more exposure. I think I agree with you that it's a great movie for people. You could just show this in your local library. It would get loads of people because loads of people are really, really worried about this issue. They might not want to hear this message, but it's an entertaining movie with lots of information. As I said, the only thing that I would have liked to have seen is something a little bit more positive about how delicious this diet is and how you can get used to it. I think that's something that people just seem to miss, that of course it doesn't taste good when you first try it. It's much less intense than the diet that people are used to is, but once you get used to it, it tastes just as good. You know, I've been there, and I'm a poster child for falling off the wagon, but I'm also hopefully the poster child for getting back on and remembering. Once you get used to eating like this, it's delicious. But we have to find ways to make it easier. I think that's really the key.
The movie is Chow Down, and you could find it online at chowdownmovie.com, and you could pick up a DVD there as well, and I hope you do, and I hope that you schedule a screening with your community, because that is what this film really, I think, is there for. So, great. It was a great film, and that was our podcast for today. A nice positive way of ending it. Please visit our website at ourhenhouse.org. Email us at info@ourhenhouse.org. Become our Facebook fan. And if you like what you're listening to, please leave us a friendly comment on iTunes. It really does make a difference, and a nice little rating too. And join us for our launch party in New York City on October 1st. There's information on our website if you click on party time, which is at the top. It's on October 1st at 8 p.m. at Mushu's. Jane Velez Mitchell will be our special guest. We also have Victoria Moran and Joshua Katcher speaking there. And we have music, raffles, cake, chocolate, and wine. I mean, what could be finer?
Talking about healthy food.
Exactly, and it's all made out of kale. Thank you for joining us today. See you next week.